paid into Medicare for decades. Don't spend retirement limping. The Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. It's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Props to...
Here's John Williams.
Props to... Matt Davidson. Hi, this is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. And we're here until 3 o'clock. We're also weekdays 1 to 3 and Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 12 noon on social media. Find me at WGN King John. That's the fancy handle we have. You'll find the news click and other things that we're talking about, other bits of information and fun. WGN King John. On the internet, our news click question, a daily web poll question, by the way, we'll just get this out of the way while I'm thinking about it, was yesterday ball or strike for Rizzo in the last at bat at Sunday's Cubs game. Was that a ball or was it a strike? Very controversial call. And this is Chicago. We have Chicago Cubs fans listening to and clicking on our website. And 44% of you said that that was a strike and that he should have been rung up, but 56% of you said it was a ball. I thought it would be way more one-sided on that. I thought everybody was going to say that was not a strike, it was a ball, and while 56% of you said, yeah, it was a ball, it wasn't 90% of you who said it was a ball. Almost half said, I think that might have been a strike. I think it might have cut the plate. It's funny because even the umpire went back and looked at it and said, oh, gee, I blew that one.
We can't agree on anything anymore.
Isn't that sad? I mean, this is Chicago. We're Cubs fans. Rizzo said it was a ball. The umpire came back and said it was a ball. And because some of you just have to be that way, I'm one of them a lot of the times I know, I think it might have been a strike. Yeah. Our news click today, Pat Quinn wants to limit mayoral terms to two. Do you agree? If you're Mayor Rahm Emanuel, with one M, you may not agree. But maybe you think that's a good idea. Should we limit the mayor's terms to two? Now, I think I know what Thomas Jefferson says about this. Thomas Jefferson, I'm not sure. I believe he says you already have term limits. It's called the ballot box. If you don't like somebody, throw them out. You could throw them out after one term. You could impeach them before the term is over if they're doing a terrible job or something illegal. So you already have term limits. You don't need to limit their terms. But George Washington said, let's only make it two terms for president. I'm not sure what Thomas Jefferson will say about this. Pat Quinn will join us in a couple of seconds, but he needed to get so many signatures on petitions to actually get it on the ballot. And if that happens in November, then come this next re-election for Pat Quinn, he would not even be eligible to run. Now, the Tribune and Kristen McQuarrie, I noticed, said, oh, don't worry. Rahm's got a lot of money, a lot of lawyers, and he's going to fight this. I'm just curious what you think about it. Should we limit the mayoral terms to two in the city of Chicago? There's Pat Quinn, the former governor, and the guy behind this petition drive on the phone. Governor Quinn, it's John. You're back on the air. How are you?
Well, very good, John. It's good to talk to you. And, we want to salute all the people who signed our petition for term limits on the mayor and circulated it. We had a broad coalition from every neighborhood, every walk of life. We're down there at City Hall yesterday, and under the Constitution of Illinois, the people in each city, including our own, Chicago, have a right to petition for a binding referendum asking whether the mayor should be limited to two terms. They've done this in every big city in America except Chicago. Of the 10 largest cities in America, 9 of the 10 have a term limit on the mayor. Chicago is the only one without it, and I want to give people a chance to vote on the issue and vote their conscience on November 6th.
Is this directed specifically at Rahm Emanuel? You want him out? Or put it this way. First answer this, Governor Quinn. Do you think Rahm Emanuel's doing a good job?
There's room for improvement, a lot of improvement. I think this weekend showed that. I think it isn't personal, though, John. The whole principle of term limits has really taken hold in our country, certainly in the last decade, and especially in municipalities where New York had this referendum and the people there in New York City passed it, and Los Angeles and Philadelphia and Houston. And we're a big city, and you know, the mayor has a lot of power, and certainly with all the new campaign finance raising of money, the huge big money in politics, kind of underlines the need for the ultimate campaign finance reform, which is term limits on the incumbent after 8 years. That's a pretty good amount of time. If they can't get the job done, then maybe it's time to step aside.
Pat, what if Rahm Emanuel was doing a great job by your estimation? Would you still be doing this? Would you still be trying to limit his terms?
Yeah, I'm like George Washington. I believe in the principle of term limits. I think he showed back when he was president the first time back in our country's beginning, one of the founding fathers. At that time, King George in England had been on the throne for 59 years, and George Washington voluntarily stepped aside after two terms and kind of set a precedent for American democracy that one person in the same office for too long, that's not always healthy for democracy, and it's good to have an opportunity to have competition, and especially now in the 21st century where you have all the big money and these super PACs and super super PACs, all this campaign money. You know, I don't think it's healthy to limit competition, and one of the best ways to open up the door to new candidates is term limits on the incumbent, and this has happened in Los Angeles. It happened in Houston. They elected their first woman mayor. First Hispanic mayor was elected in Los Angeles, and many other cities have had San Francisco elected an Asian-American mayor. It's an opportunity to have real diversity and real competition.
Yeah, right. Would this be for all mayors' offices in the state, or are you just interested in Chicago with this petition?
Well, no, you got to do it city by city. Already, John, 25 Illinois cities in their own city have put a term limit on their mayors, like Springfield, Illinois did, and Naperville, and Downers Grove, Oak Lawn, Des Plaines, and 25 altogether. And Chicago has never had this referendum, and the referendum we're talking about would apply only to Chicago, to the office of mayor, and it would be a two-term limit, which is the same as what the president has, and that ought to be enough time to get the job done. And this will be the very first time in the history of Chicago, 181-year history, that a binding referendum has been put on the ballot by voter petition, and the voters get a chance to vote yes or no. And if they vote yes, they make the law. The people of Chicago have the final say. The mayor can't change it. The city council can't change it. They have to accept the results of the referendum on November 6th.
I'm reading from Kristen McQuarrie online, one of the editorial writers and sometimes columnists at the Chicago Tribune. She's also a regular on our Mincing Rascals podcast. She notes that you filed roughly 6,000 pages of citizen signatures. She noted you needed 52,519 valid signatures to get the measure on the ballot. And you were at the city's clerk's office yesterday with 86,481 signatures. So if those stand up, then it'll be on the ballot. And then is it just a simple majority of 51% of us say we like the idea, then Rahm can't run?
That's right. The majority, 50.1, one more than 50%, will make the decision.
Isn't part of the problem,
obviously, get a
isn't part
bigger
of the problem
number
with
than
this,
that?
Pat, that what if somebody's doing a great, what if crime had been cut in half, or what if people think that Rahm is doing a good job, and you know what happened this weekend?
You know, in New York, they had term limits but set them aside after September 11th.
Well, that was Rudy Giuliani's idea, right?
I think he wanted that.
They
didn't. I'm sorry.
Fair enough, Steve. I mean, it's a good point. He petitioned that because he thought he was doing such a good job, and people did like him at that time. Roe reminds us, because he followed this story more closely than I did, and we talked about it the other day, that leading up to that, his extracurricular activities, people were fed up with in New York. But right afterwards, there was some momentum to give him a third term. Okay, so back to Chicago, though, for just a second, Pat. What if a mayor's doing a great job? What a shame to see somebody who's doing well have to step down.
Yeah, well, I think American democracy over the really decades and centuries has found that having a two-term limit of 8 years is a reasonable amount of time for any good elected official to do a lot of good work, and having the principle of stepping aside after that period of time allows for democracy to take place and real competition. And I think even more than ever, you know, the big money in politics today, in politics, billions and millions of dollars being spent, it's not healthy to have an incumbent with $25 million and the challengers with far less than that. You can't have real competition. And so term limits are a way of, as President Obama said, bringing fresh ideas, fresh blood, new people into the system. And I really think that's the way to go. But, you know, the point of it is for both you, John, and Steve listening, there, we want to have a referendum on this. You know, the mayor hasn't ever given us a chance to do that. So we want to at least have a vote by the people after hearing the debate on whether or not we should have a two-term limit on the mayor.
All right, Pat. Well, good luck to you and good luck to the citizens. I hope their will out. That's the idea on this. You know, I mean, I'm a little torn about it. I generally lean with you on this one. But then again, if the people feel otherwise, I suppose we need to respect that, too, right?
Yeah, it'll be a good campaign. And, you know, it's the first time ever in Chicago, Machine Chicago with all the machine tradition, that the voters themselves by petition are putting a binding referendum on the ballot where they will make the final decision. And I think that's very healthy for the city to really have that kind of grassroots democracy that is the best way to protect the people. You know, John, a long time ago, Jane Addams, the first American woman to receive the Nobel Prize, she lived in Chicago. She lived 100 years ago. She said the cure for the ills of democracy is more democracy. So that's really what we're trying to do with the term limit on the mayor referendum, give people a chance to speak.
Didn't there used to be a guy around and said, let the will of the people be the law of the land?
Yeah, very intelligent fellow. I'm fumbling for his name. Yeah, he served as a governor once.
He was governor and treasurer, quite a lot of things.
Oh, no kidding. Are you quoting Pat Quinn there?
Yeah, that was one of the governor's favorite sayings, I think.
How about that?
Yeah, let the will of the people be the law of the land. And, you know, it's very important. They always keep that in mind. If we're going to have a better democracy, we've got to have more voter voice.
You're not referring to yourself in the third person, are you, Pat? Because that's just...
No,
that doesn't seem like you.
I'm responding to the excellent, insightful comment of Steve Bertrand.
Okay, I got to go. You do too. But listen, we've got a nice pair of tickets for you and your friends at the Thomas Jefferson Show. I want you to bring this up with him. I think it'd be very interesting for a packed audience at the College of DuPage at a sold-out show to hear you and him exchange on this.
All right, sounds good. Okay, John.
Thank you, sir. That's Pat Quinn, Thomas Jefferson's show, on stage with me at the College of DuPage, Saturday, August 18th. I think you can get in on the 10 o'clock show. Maybe you can't. I know some tickets are still available for the 1 o'clock show. There's a couple of texts from some of our listeners who have been to the Thomas Jefferson shows before. He walks onto stage with me. We chat a little bit. You ask questions. It's amazing. My ticket was my birthday gift from my grown son, wrote Deanna, who accompanied me. I've been wanting to see WGN, King John, and Thomas Jefferson for years, but the tickets sold out so fast. My history buff son enjoyed it too, and TJ made some comments that foreshadowed the election outcome. This was a July 14th tweet at us, but obviously referring to the show that we did just before the 2016 election. And Felice wrote, I asked my 13-year-old grandson to accompany me. He thoroughly enjoyed the presentation. We even had a conversation about the topics that were discussed. He did not pick up his cell phone for the entire 20-minute ride home. That's a big deal. It really is. How do you get tickets? Go to WGNradio.com/events. My friend David McCallie and I were at White Sox Park last night. We were at Guaranteed Rate. We were watching the Yankees. It's funny because the Yankees come to town, and then I think there were more Yankees fans, to be fair, than there were White Sox fans last night. I mean, you know, it's not every day they come here, and the Yankees, though 9 games out, are in the hunt, and the White Sox aren't, so maybe it was not surprising that you had a lot of Yankees fans there. It's funny because Aaron Judge is one of the big stars, of course, of the Yankees. He didn't play last night. People show up in Judge's robes with Judge's wigs. They are the Judges. And they are there to see Aaron Judge play. They didn't get a chance to. That's okay. The Yankees pretty much dominated that game. So much so at the end of the game, we put in this relief pitcher who's actually a position player. His name is Matt Davidson. He's maybe a corner infielder. I thought he might have been a catcher. He's hit 15 home runs this year. Kevin Powell joins us on WGN Radio. Hey, Kevin, how are you?
I'm great. Matt Davidson is a third baseman, a first baseman, and a DH, basically a American League slugger type player.
His ERA, after how many outings? Three now? Is
three outings.
0.00. He has not allowed an earned run yet.
Ah! This is a growing trend around baseball, John, using position players late in games, particularly when the games are blowouts, because it saves the bullpen. It keeps your relievers fresh, and it doesn't tax your bullpen.
Right,
so
we've seen
Joe Maddon use it about four or five players this year alone, including Anthony Rizzo. I like the move. I think it makes sense. And Matt Davidson is not just a random position player they're plucking off the field and putting him out. He can pitch. He was throwing some pretty good stuff out there last night.
Well, I watched the game in person, and then we'd watch some of the replays, and you saw the speed gun. His fastball was 91-92, but the funny thing was that's not what was working for him. It was his 72-mile-an-hour curveball. High school players see 72-mile-an-hour curveballs. That's a fact. But I think the problem with pro players is that they're used to 90-mile-an-hour breaking balls, and they just couldn't figure this stuff out. I mean, Giancarlo Stanton looked really bad against a 70-mile-an-hour pitch that bounced in front of him. He swung and missed, struck out on that pitch.
Well, I'm glad you noticed that. I actually asked Matt Davidson that after the game. I said, look, you threw a 92-mile-per-hour heater and followed that up with a 70-mile-per-hour breaking ball, and he just struck out one of the premier power hitters in all of baseball, Giancarlo Stanton. And Matt Davidson grew up a pitcher. He told us last night his dream was always to be a pitcher in the big leagues. So he knows what he's doing on the mound. And, John, I wouldn't be completely surprised if you see maybe next year in spring training teams sort of identify an emergency-type pitcher.
Yeah.
And they say, why don't you throw a few bullpen sessions and you're going to be our guy. In a blowout game, you'll be our guy. So it's a growing trend around baseball. I think it makes sense. There is a fine line. You don't want to make it an embarrassing moment for anybody.
Yeah.
But I think it makes sense for a lot of teams.
I think that's well put. And here's just a little factoid to leave you with, and then we got to go, Kev. Are you in the house yet? Are you in the building?
No, I'm in my car. I'm just parking now. I'll be in just a few minutes.
Well, so here's a little trivia fact for you. You probably know the answer to this. Who is the only other American League player in the history of the game to hit 15 home runs in a game and pitch this many scoreless innings?
15 homers in a season and pitch this many scoreless innings. I'm going to go with Babe Ruth.
In the same season, Babe Ruth and Matt Davidson are the only two that have ever done that.
There you go. It's a fun stat of the day.
Talk to you later, man.
It's fun, isn't it?
It is.
All right, John, thanks.
You know, and for last night, where there wasn't much for us to root for, sitting there in the ninth inning, that was fun to see. That was our takeaway. It's 1:29. Steve's got the news coming up. I'm John Williams. You know, Steve, a week ago I was talking about the environment. We were talking about straws and dolphins. I was talking about how if you use styrofoam cups versus, say, regular porcelain mugs,
right,
that maybe the styrofoam cups are better for the environment.
You were shaking us because all of us who thought we were doing the right thing, you argued maybe or were pointing out that maybe we weren't.
In retrospect, I've been a little worried that all of the information I was pumping out there wasn't 100% true. I was recollecting a couple of pieces that were written by John Tierney, who is the science columnist for the New York Times and an editor to City Journal. So I thought I'd just sort of make sure that you heard it right and I got it right. John joins us again on WGN Radio. Hey, John, it's John Williams. You're on the air. How are you this afternoon?
Fine, John. Thanks for inviting me.
Here's the promotional commercial we ran for my show today. John Tierney writes about science for the New York Times. Should I care about plastic straws here since we got no dolphins? And there's one thing that's got us going last week. What's better for the planet, using disposable styrofoam cups or a regular mug that you rinse out every day? Listen at 1:35. Well, here it is, 1:38. Care to jump in there at any point, John?
Yes. The answer to both is, the first question is no, don't worry about plastic straws. I mean, you know, the plastic straw bans are really just kind of green craziness, and that they're bad for people and probably bad for the environment. You know, people worry about plastic waste in the ocean. It is a problem. But, you know, less than 1% of that comes from the United States, and just a tiny portion of that is plastic straws. So it's a minuscule problem, and banning them, it basically, it's bad for the environment in several ways. They've got to be replaced with paper straws that are heavier, that consume more energy to manufacture and ship, and that cost about at least six times as much. And they tend to, they go bad after about 16 months or so. So it's more expensive for people, and it's actually probably adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere because there's more energy involved in manufacturing and shipping those straws.
Stop right there. So you also said that every word you said was fascinating to me and upsetting to, I think, our mindset. And that's one of those instances where the guy says something, okay, I believe everything he just said. He's right. I don't know if I can emotionally accept that plastic is better than paper, but you said that less than 1% of that mass of pollution in the ocean comes from the United States?
That's right. You know, almost all, most of it, the great majority of it comes from Asian countries, China and Indonesia and some other countries that have much more lax environmental standards than we do. And they dump, and their plastic often gets up when it's processed or just when it's thrown away and it gets dumped into rivers and it ends up going into the ocean. In fact, you know, this is something that I just learned, that part of that plastic in the ocean, it comes via Asia, but it's actually a result of recycling programs in the United States and Europe. Because when I wrote about recycling for the New York Times, I wrote about it 20 years ago and said it made no sense. And I wrote about, and I revisited it a couple years ago, and it made even less sense. And you know, recycling was started with the idea that that we were running out of all these materials, and that they were going to get more expensive, and there'd be a huge demand for all these recycled materials. Well, there isn't. And so, you know, so what actually happens with the plastic that you put in the recycling bin, a lot of it is quietly just dumped in landfills because no one wants to buy it. And then some of it is shipped to Asia because there has been a market there for some of this, these recyclables. But because they have such lax environmental standards, some of that plastic bottle that you so carefully put in the bin, that could, you know, a not insignificant portion of the stuff that goes to Asia ends up in their rivers and ends up in the ocean. So we'd be much better off throwing those plastic bottles in a landfill near our homes instead of it ending up in the Pacific. And that's why I say, as you say, that people have this emotional connection. And I've always thought of environmentalism that there's a large part of it that is religious, basically, that, you know, recycling is a sacrament people do to feel good. The plastic straw ban makes some people feel virtuous. It makes some politicians feel that they're doing something for the planet, but they're actually not. They're actually imposing, they're making life more costly, more inconvenient for people, and they're actually hurting the environment.
Well, that's interesting because I'm glad you put it those. Yeah, hey Steve, you're talking to me, buddy. You need to be talking to Griffin. Back with our guest on the air. So, you mentioned in one of your pieces, it was The Reign of Recycling, which I think was the follow up to Recycling is Garbage. Two of your seminal pieces about this, and people say, okay, so I'm just going to throw that plastic in the earth instead of recycling. It seems like a double whammy. Bad enough that we made plastic and that I've used it, but now I'm going to stick it in the ground. And yet you said something like, if you took all of the trash that we generated for the next 1,000 years, that would fit into 0.1% of the available land we use for grazing. Are you standing by that? Is that as profound a statement as I think it is?
Well, I certainly stand by it. No one has ever challenged it. I mean, the whole recycling crisis began, you know, with that garbage barge about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And there was this idea that we're running out of space, which was always crazy. I mean, people point out at the time, we have plenty of room. You know, we're actually, you know, losing farmland that's turning to forest. We have plenty of open space in this country. And, you know, and what happens in those landfills is you put something in there, and modern landfills have all these safety liners. They burn off the methane that's generated. You know, they don't, and they're basically located out in rural areas where, you know, they're buffered by greenery from people. And the local residents welcome them because they pay big taxes. You know, it's a good economic
Okay, I get that, John, but answer me this question. Tell me if this makes any sense. Is it possible, though, that putting those plastics into the earth a zillion years from now or maybe sooner, those plastics will break down into compounds that will poison future generations, that's just hiding the problem?
I don't see how it would. I mean, plastic's very stable. You know, in those landfills, you know, when they've dug them up and there have been some garbologists who actually dig up landfills, they found that in that airless environment, even newspaper doesn't break down much. They can read newspapers from 50 years ago, and plastic is far more stable. I mean, the way I look at it is that plastic all came out of the ground. It was in the form of oil.
Right.
And so turning it into plastic, which is more stable than oil, it doesn't leak, it doesn't do anything, it's just going back in the ground. And then you cover it up and you turn it into a park or a golf course. I mean, it's not a great loss to humanity.
Okay, here's another thing that I've been walking around with, and that is that if I am going to recycle, I should recycle paper, cardboard, and soda cans, aluminum cans. After that, there's not much point to recycling. Do I understand that correctly by your estimation?
Yes, that's very true. For, you know, there is some market, it depends where you live, but there's definitely a market for soda cans because aluminum, it takes a lot of energy to produce aluminum, so that's one of the few materials and garbage that's valuable. And in a lot of places, there is a market for paper and cardboard. And one of the unfortunate things about recycling mania is by promising to do more and more, we have to throw all these materials in. It makes everything, it makes it much harder to recycle the stuff that is worthwhile.
Right.
Because, you know,
right,
they spend so much time picking the junk out. I mean, plastic, there's very little, there's no market for it, really. Glass is terrible because there's absolutely no market for glass. It's made out of sand, but there's no shortage of sand in the world. And it breaks, and so it breaks in the recycling, and they've got to pick out the pieces of glass. And so the more materials that you try to recycle, the more you add to that bin, the harder it gets to actually extract the valuable
one. I thought that when we were recycling, it didn't matter if it was broken or not, they were going to melt it all down and make new glass. In fact, recycling glass bottles means they're going to literally use that same intact glass bottle again?
No, it's not that. I mean, they will melt it down. The problem is that those broken shards of glass get mixed up with everything else in the recycling belt.
I got that.
And
okay,
so the workers have to wear heavy gloves. The machine, the broken glass ends up breaking the machinery, and it's just a huge hassle to separate it.
Okay, I've also been trotting this around because I learned it from John Tierney that I'm probably better off using a disposable styrofoam cup for my coffee every day, a throwaway one that I throw away rather than rinsing out my porcelain mug. Is that correct?
That is correct. It was, you know, and I've forgotten the exact number. This was a study done, you know, 30 years ago, but they calculated the energy use that's involved in manufacturing a styrofoam cup and the energy that's used in manufacturing a mug and then in washing it over and over. And they calculated that, you know, it's something like 300 or 500, or might have even been, you know, 800 times that you had to use the mug in order for it to equal the energy of the styrofoam mug. In other words, up until the 800th use, something like that, the styrofoam mug used less energy.
And that doesn't even calculate the cost of the heating the water to rinse it out if you're rinsing it out with hot water, right?
That's what they were calculating. They were calculating that involved. Yeah, yeah.
What about this? Sure. Here's just another kind of science environmental question for you. Did California's environmental policies make the fires worse in California? Have you had any chance to dig into that issue? The president tweeted about that, and I didn't know any of the science behind that. I'd never heard that. I saw a report this morning, and a firefighter refuted it, but he wasn't a scientist. I wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
You know, I don't know that, and you know, my motto, and when you're a contrarian as I am about the environment, you really have to be very sure of your facts. So
yeah.
I don't talk unless I know it. I mean, I'm skeptical of people who blame it on climate change, but I don't know the facts, and I'm skeptical, and I don't know. It's possible that there were environmental policies that, I mean, there certainly have been bad policies in the forest before that caused, you know, by fighting fires, we end up with giant blazes, you know. Instead of the more natural cycle where you get a small fire, clears out an area, and the trees come back. And if you keep suppressing fires, then you end up with one giant inferno. So we certainly have seen that in Yellowstone and other places.
Yeah. The science writing contrarian for the New York Times. What are you putting in the paper next? What are you working on right now, John?
I'm finishing a book with Roy Baumeister, who's a very prominent social psychologist. He and I wrote a book called Willpower about self-control, and that did well. It was the bestseller. So we follow, and we're about next year we're coming out with a book about why, about negativity bias, why our brains are so fixated on bad things and why we overreact to them. And some of these environmental, you know, this idea that humanity is doomed, that these things pose an existential threat to us, that's part of that book about why we so readily listen to people who have these apocalyptic prophecies, when in fact almost every measure of human welfare is improving. You know, we live incredibly well, but we keep thinking that things are getting worse.
I think that's a really, I've been reading a book by a researcher from Harvard. What's the title of the book? And he said, we're living in the best of times.
Okay, Steve Pinker, yeah. It's a great book. And it's called Enlightenment Now. And he and I and other people have been saying this for decades. You know, everything's getting better. Why do we think it's getting worse?
I'll tell you what, and if you don't, maybe that misses the point, because you go, well, wait a minute, it's not so good now. We have disparity and blah, blah, blah. But here's what we had back in the old days. People died. People killed each other. There was disease. I mean, really, if you had to pick a time to live in, this might not be perfect. It might not be living to its potential, but good grief.
So that's the
question
I've posed before. Like, would you rather live as a lower middle class or even poor person today or a king in the 13th century?
Century? That's a good question. What's your answer to that, John?
Oh, much better today. I mean, middle class people today live better, and I've got, and this is in our book. You know, we live better than King Louis XIV. You know, we have things that he couldn't. We live longer. We have so many amenities that he doesn't have, and you know, and the fact that there were very few kings. You know, for most of history until the Industrial Revolution, just about everybody was poor. You know, so we worry about income inequality, but we, you know, we used to be all poor.
There wasn't any. It was equal. It was dead. Recycling is Garbage is his 1996 piece. A decade later, he wrote about it again, The Reign of Recycling. He writes all the time about science. John Tierney from the New York Times. What a pleasure, John. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you, let's visit again.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, sir. Thanks again to John Tierney from the New York Times. He kind of covers both of his bases. He puts out upsetting information, then, and he says, if you don't agree with it, it's because you have information bias. It's negative or hostile to your existing beliefs, and therefore you're hesitant to accept them, but my beliefs are right and your beliefs are wrong. And then he's got that sort of, you know,
You're so in the bag with him, too.
Why wouldn't I be?
Because...
I mean, I know it's...
I'm the voice of the listeners right now. We heard from a few, but we're running out of time right now, but...
Yeah.
He upset many people.
Why?
Just now.
Why?
Because of everything he said.
I know.
What he means is, why not?
I mean, right. So out of the gate, it's plastic straws are better than paper straws. And
I think that was the least of it.
And they don't even matter.
Yeah.
Okay, so what was the upsetting part, Griffin?
Well, we're trying to move on, but... Somebody said, he said that there's no sand shortage, and that was just a footnote. Somebody called in, no, there is a sand shortage.
There is a sand shortage, damn it.
And I looked it up, and there is. There are stories that say there is. So it's just.
Do you believe him when he said that less than 1% of that mass of garbage floating in the ocean comes from the United States?
I think it's all up to debate. It's not all up to debate, but there are many viewpoints. It's like such an encompassing thing. And it's complicated, and it's important to hear his side.
Fair enough. I'm glad you're saying that, because I'm a sucker for a scientist, and anybody that says I'm a scientist, I go, oh, then you're smarter than me, and I believe you. And I do believe him.
But why don't more scientists believe him?
Now you don't know that they don't. All right, here's what Griffin's in my ear going, hey, Roy Moore's on the phone line. Let's talk to our friend Roy Moore, or Roy Spencer. No, it's Roy Moore, which is different than Roy Spencer.
I've answered to worse, I guess.
I'm not sure if you have.
Yeah, take some time to think about that.
You may want to back off that. Hi, Roy Spencer. How are you?
I'm good, John. How you doing?
I thought I was doing fine, and then I turned around, and I thought I was leading a parade. There was nobody there. Roy Spencer is the president of Permaseal Basement Systems. Hey, I had a question for you, speaking of science and things that people do. What is more problematic for a home? And for, say, a foundation or flooding, is it a series of rains or one really super hard single rain? What's more troubling to homeowners?
It could be either one, because at the end of the day, what matters is the amount of water pressure in the ground. And so if you have a one really hard rain, odds are you're going to have a lot of water pressure pushing against your foundation because all the ground is saturated. By the same token, you could have a series of rains that eventually get to that tipping point where there's enough pressure where it starts water, you know, coming into your basement. So, you know, it typically, if you have a series of rains, if they're light rains, you might not even have a problem because there's not enough water pressure because the ground's drying out and things like that.
Yeah.
So typically, yeah, to answer your question, I think the real hard torrential rain all at once, if there's enough of it, is probably the biggest, causes the most calls.
Well, Roy, if this leads to foundation problems...
And I'm not a scientist, that's just my experience. Yeah.
Well, you just... Well, I've been told to doubt everything you say now by my friends here, but I won't. I listen, I've had great success with PermaSeal. All right, here's my next question then. So if it's just a foundation pressure problem, how can I know? What should I look for?
Okay, so what's going on right now, John? Of course, we've had, you know, a lot of rain earlier this year. Now we've had all this series of hot, dry weather, and so it's going back and forth. And what I want to call your listeners' attention to today is that's when structural problems can occur. So obviously, seepage kind of speaks for itself, and they know when they see water getting in their basement, that's not right, and they know who to call. But what they may not notice are structural problems that occur, and they occur at this time of year and going forward into the fall because of the soil drying out and then getting wet, and of course clay soil expands and shrinks, and our house is sitting on that soil. So it's going to manifest itself in some structural problems with certain homes, and I want your listeners to know what to look for there.
Give me an example.
Particularly indoors, I look for doors and windows that are all of a sudden sticking or not closing. Maybe their floor is actually seems to be sinking. There's a gap underneath the baseboard. If they do have the basement, the basement walls might appear to be bowing, and they may actually be. There may be new cracks in the drywall or particularly the exterior brickwork. So all these are signs that might just occur, and it's not your imagination. This is the time of season that can happen.
Permaseal.net, is that the website that you guys got over there, Roy?
It is.
Permaseal.net. By the way, this isn't just like interesting science. This is costly, and you want to get in front of it before it's too late, before you have something really problematic. Permaseal.net. Visit right now. Before these problems get worse, permaseal.net. Roy Spencer is the president of PermaSeal Basement Systems. Always nice to talk to you, Roy. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, John.
Well done, sir. You betcha. 157. News coming up.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
It's dawned on me.
It's John Williams.
Possible. It's just possible that sometimes when I think big thoughts and come up with grand conclusions, but you don't agree with me. Hi, it's John. I'm in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above a kind of cloudy downtown Chicago. So understand that I'm not being antagonistic now, but I am drinking a cup of coffee from a recyclable, who cares? It's a styrofoam cup.
Oh, thank you for doing that, John.
A disposable styrofoam cup.
On behalf of the world, I just want to hug you.
I've been told by somebody smarter than me, and quite possibly smarter than you, although I really haven't seen the paperwork, but I've been told by a real smart person that this is a better environmental choice. So what's better, that I cling to my old ways or that I go with the knowledge that I've just gained?
But would you agree that this one scientist has a different opinion than maybe other scientists have?
Than all the conventional wisdom.
Is he a scientist or a science writer?
Now we're just splitting.
And you break it down to smarter than me, not smarter than me. But I can find you someone smarter than you that will say not to drink out of the styrofoam cup. We can do that.
Well, okay, that's your challenge, Mr. Producer Griffin. No, I'm not kidding. I mean, really, that guy threw a lot of stuff at us, as I have parroted him in the past, that is upsetting or challenging to the conventional wisdom you carry. And listen, do I want to be better? I'm as green as they come, Jack.
What am I going to judge people over now?
Oh, their personal views and politics, but not on their recycling choices. He said you're better off just throwing it away. Okay, but literally, so later this week, Griff, let's find somebody smarter than me, randomly, and let's ask them if they can give us a scientific different view than the science writer John Tierney gave us. Again, his seminal piece in The New York Times years ago was recycling
in 96.
So when you read that 20 years ago, you said that's going to be a topic one day, right? It's been sitting in your brain for 20 years?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And it's come up again since. The science hasn't changed. Hey, we're out of time. I want to talk a little bit about the trial that is taking place. So this is the Manafort story, and following it is ABC producer-reporter Ali Rogan. Ali, it's John Williams. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
Hey, John. I'm doing great. Thanks.
Where are you right now?
So I am ensconced in my cozy Washington Bureau office, and we have colleagues who are in the courtroom. It's a rather limited courtroom in terms of reporting, because you're not allowed to have cell phones or laptops or anything of the like in there. So in between, they're running in and out of the courtroom, giving us out here periodic updates. That's how we can bring all the news to you.
What are you hearing today?
So Rick Gates, who is Manafort's former second-in-command, is on the stand right now, and he just finished up being questioned by the prosecution, for whom he is their star witness. And he's just about to begin cross-examination by the defense, and it's going to be very interesting because Manafort's lawyers are trying to pin their entire argument on the notion that Rick Gates, when he was working for Manafort, deceived him and is actually the mastermind of all the crimes that Manafort is alleged to have committed.
So he was conned by the con man, huh?
Exactly.
Does the fact that he's cutting, does the jury know that he's cutting a deal?
I believe the jury has been made aware of that. It's something that the prosecution certainly has been leaning on and leaning into as they question Rick Gates. He has established this plea agreement, although he hasn't yet been sentenced, but he has pleaded down his punishment in order to provide the most extensive testimony he can. And, oh boy, it has been extensive. Right now he's in his fifth hour of testimony, and he's been talking about how he helped Paul Manafort keep these 15 offshore bank accounts. He helped him file phony bank loan applications when the money in those offshore bank accounts started to dry up. He worked with Manafort's accountants, who were also in on this alleged behavior, to they were listing Manafort's income as loans to offset his tax burden, and they were listing some other income as loan forgiveness when he began allegedly trying to commit bank fraud. So it's a tangled web of alleged crimes going on here, and Gates is testifying to the effect that he was right in the middle of all of it, and that Paul Manafort was expressly aware of everything that was going on.
Well, I wonder, regardless of whose idea was, Gates says I was doing Manafort's bidding. Manafort said I was being duped by Gates. But
yeah.
Regardless, how does Manafort not realize at some point that he's being scammed? I mean, at some point he had to have known, and if he did nothing, then you might conclude he was in on it, right?
I mean, it's so complicated, John, and I think that's something we're going to hear a lot from the argument that the prosecution is making. I mean, perhaps Manafort knew, but Gates has testified under oath that he was doing this unbeknownst to Manafort. That the thing that, let me just take a step back and say that Gates has also testified that he embezzled money from Paul Manafort. He said tens of thousands of dollars he was embezzling. So that actually bolsters Manafort's lawyer's case,
right,
that
right,
this was all Rick Gates' fault.
Is this a fair question? Is Gates credible? I wonder how he's doing.
Right.
Does he seem believable?
That's certainly something the defense is going to seek to erode his credibility, but he is certainly a flawed witness, and some of our legal experts at ABC News have acknowledged that, you know, even the prosecution knows that he's a flawed witness. Before he struck this plea deal, he was lying to investigators. So he's not exactly the most credible witness to take to be the star witness, but you could also argue that this man has nothing more to lose. So why wouldn't he be completely honest?
Yeah, I know it sounds like I want Manafort to go to jail. Maybe I do, maybe I don't. But it just seems to me like if you have a corrupt enterprise, of course the people that are going to talk about it, if you're going to get somebody on the inside, will have been corrupt. But it doesn't mean that to save their own skin, they aren't going to tell you how it went down. I mean, I believe that he was a liar and that he's telling the truth now. That can happen. I don't know. I don't know if it is happening right now, but I don't think I would, by virtue of that, automatically dismiss everything Gates is saying. You know what I mean?
Oh, exactly. I heard someone this morning, you know, make a good analogy that birds of a feather fly together, especially corrupt birds of a feather, right? So you've got this guy who is acknowledging this alleged corruption
right.
on the stand.
Yeah.
It may follow, and prosecutors are certainly seeking to make the argument that it follows that Manafort, who was his boss, is also corrupt and is the root of this corruption. You know, with that said, Gates is the defense lawyers certainly have a stronger case to make now that Gates has acknowledged that that he, you know, took advantage of Manafort in this way, even though the money he embezzled was nothing compared to the amount of money that Paul Manafort was spending. You know, he spent the money.
Right.
You can.
Well, we're talking hundreds of thousands versus tens of millions of dollars.
Tens of millions.
It seems to be petty by comparison. So they're leading with their star witness here. Are other people going to testify for the prosecution?
There are others. The prosecution has a list of 35 witnesses, and Rick Gates is either 15 or 16. So they're about halfway through. And right now he is under cross-examination, which will probably take the rest of the afternoon. It's 3:15 here on the East Coast. And then presumably we're going to hear from the next witness for the prosecution. That may not be until tomorrow. The jury may have had enough for the day. But I think that the rest of the witnesses are going to fill in some of the details and further color the argument that the prosecution is seeking to make. Certainly Rick Gates is the guy to kind of lead them down the path of everything that Paul Manafort is alleged to have done.
Ali Rogan's a producer and reporter at ABC News. All right, Ali, I appreciate your time and your ear today. I know you're listening and following this. Let's touch bases again later in the week, all right?
Sounds good. Thanks, John.
Yeah, thank you for your time in reporting there. It's 2:17. There's a couple of TV shows that I'm watching that I want to bounce off of you. Tell me if you're watching these, and do you have the same reaction I do? And maybe when we come back to Steve, you had as a little story at the end of one of your newscasts, a note about Lady Gaga is going to do two concerts, right? And one of them will be her hits, and one of them will be jazzier stuff.
John, there are no little stories. yeah, she's going to do a residency in Vegas starting December 28th, and you can choose her hits or her smoky smooth jazz show.
Which one would you pick?
You know, it's funny because I prefer smoky smooth jazz to her hits, but if you're going to see someone like that, you'd want to see, I don't know. I think I'd want to see them do the
hits. Well, the question is, will Tony Bennett be in her smoky jazz?
I don't know.
Because she does a Christmas album with
him. Well, she toured with him a number of years ago.
It was so good, too. And when, Tony Bennett can do that. I haven't heard Tony Bennett sing lately, right? Online or whatever. But as a guy in his 70s, Tony 80s, Tony has still been really good. And the song, the duet that he did with Amy Winehouse, I thought was just so good and tragic. I would go if it was... If it was Lady Gaga, I would go the smoky jazzy stuff because I'm not a big Lady Gaga fan. Love Lady Gaga, support Lady Gaga. But
you're not a big fan of her hits. You
right.
don't love her hits, right?
I love what she is. I don't love what she always does. So if you just said her singing her hits, that wouldn't be as meaningful to me as her stretching her wings a little bit and trying something a little different. I think I would go with that. But if it was a group that I really loved and I really wanted to hear them do my songs, then I would say play the hits. Griff, what was the example you were pointing out to me? Somebody, I said, do other artists do something like this?
Yeah, I think a lot of bands will do this. In high school, I was really into a band called The Decemberists, which to some might be embarrassing now. Who's to say? I feel a little embarrassed about it now.
Well, we all listened to them because you did, actually, because your dad was playing around the station.
Right, yeah, well, you're welcome. But they, back then they did a tour where they did two dates in every city, and I can't remember the exact specifics, but it was something like one night they would do all of their songs that were 4 minutes and shorter, and then the next night they would do all their songs that were like 7 minutes and longer. So one was all short songs, one was all their long songs, and we went to the long songs.
So did you hear that? Did the Sporting Life come in the long
song? No, that would be it. Well,
short? It's that, kind of on the bubble. That's about a 4 minute song, isn't it?
That might have been in no man's land in the middle there, where they didn't get played at all.
That's their, hey, let's take a break and come back with some Sporting Life.
I shouldn't have said anything.
From the Decemberists. It's one of the great songs ever recorded. And Griffin, it's not your show.
The season was almost done.
Hey, it's Decemberists. I don't know what happened to the song. It just stopped. Hit play again if you can find it, Griff. Oh, doggone it, because...
Well, I'm streaming it, and it it cut out on me.
The stream stopped. That wasn't you, because you didn't want to play the song and are doing so under protest. You didn't accidentally, intentionally stop it, did you?
That was divine.
Was it sabotage?
Well, here's the
divine deal. Intervention.
So that was a song by the Decemberists, which we were just talking about sort of offhand a moment ago. Griffin said he's embarrassed to admit that he used to listen to them, but one of my all-time favorite songs is that by the Decemberists. It's called Sporting Life.
I love them, but a little embarrassed.
I don't know enough about the Decemberists or music to know why that would be embarrassing. I always thought I was talking pretty good when I go, well, I like the Decemberists. You think I should back off that a little bit?
They were fashionable at the time. You were good back then.
Okay, but here's why I really like this song, The Sporting Life, because it is a lament about not being able to perform athletically. You're a young man. People are judging you, your girlfriend, your father, the coach, the school, by how well you do on the field, and he fails on the field. There's a line or two that goes like this. There's my father looking on, and there's my girlfriend arm in arm with the captain of the other team. And all of this is clear to me. They condescend and fix on me a frown, how they love the Sporting Life. And I hear that. I just feel so bad for him. I mean, what a sad song. And it's just kind of got an upbeat little tone to it. So he's telling you this story, but it's a sad story about the Sporting Life. The first line is, I fell on the playing field, the work of an errant heel. The din of the crowd and the loud commotion went deafening silence and stopped emotion. The season was almost done. We managed it 12-1. So far, I had known no humiliation in front of my friends and close relations, but then, of course, things go badly. Song. I love that whole song. I love that whole thing. I'm watching three TV shows right now, and all of them have the same thing in common. And whenever I get into a rut like this, I vow I'm going to stop doing it, but they do it so well, you're sort of attracted to and repulsed by them at the same time. I'm watching Billions, which is the show about a billionaire, a money manager, and the district attorney who's trying to throw him in jail. And the district attorney is even more reprehensible than the billionaire. And everybody around them is completely flawed. So it's this titanic battle between these two forces, the law, quote-unquote. The attorney for the Southern District of New York is just as corrupt as the billionaire, but it's these two guys battling it out. And it's beautiful, and it's interesting to watch, but there's nobody to cheer for in that show. The other show we've been watching is Succession, which is sort of a Rupert Murdoch spinoff, right, Griff? Loosely based on the Murdochs and Fox News and all of that.
So I see the pattern. It shows with one-word titles.
No, Steve. It shows where all of the characters, however fascinating, are reprehensible. If you think Billions is bad, watch Succession just to... They are miserable, dysfunctional, nutty people. It's a really good show. It's and by the way, I just watched last night, as I'm catching up on it, the worst Thanksgiving scene. You know how Thanksgivings can go bad for a family? Like, oh, here's a long-lost family member. Let's all sit down and have a nice meal. But, gee, Thanksgiving, that's a lot of pressure. Maybe we shouldn't do it here now. It is one awful, awful moment after another. This Thanksgiving meal will never end. Succession. And then I've been also watching Sharp Objects, which, you know, I'm actually rooting for some of the characters in this. But, whew, is that
it scary?
It's based on it's fiction, but a couple of girls have been killed in a horrible way. They're trying to figure out who did it. The cops are working on it, maybe not hard enough, and a reporter from nearby comes back home to report on this as well.
It's based on the novel from Gillian Flynn, who did Gone Girl, so imagine that.
And I haven't read, I don't know how this story ends. You may, but I don't know how Sharp Objects ends. I can't figure out who did it. And you wonder if the reporter's going to get her life on track. She self-injures herself. She's one of those people. She cuts herself, to say nothing of her abuse of alcohol. She's out of control, but you're rooting for her. Her mother is a terrible person. So these are my three favorite shows right now.
All very relatable.
No, it's like, I don't know if maybe a show about normal folks who are happy would be interesting. These are interesting shows, but you just watch them and you're waylaid. You know what I mean? It's 2:29. I need to pause. Steve's got the news. We'll finish this conversation after the news. And also, Little League manager is going to talk to us. Thank you, Steve. Do you think it's a little truth to this, Steve? We will know them by the TV shows they watch. And I don't know if I'm talking about the TV shows I watch before the break says much about me. We watch Billions, Succession, and Sharp Objects. Those are the three shows I'm spending a lot of time in front
yes,
of.
Yes.
Not a happy show among them, and just a lot of, you know, suffering people there. It's not healthy. I don't think I should.
I'm watching Ozark now, based on your recommendation
and what are you
Sharon's.
Thinking?
And it's the same thing. I mean, not that they're despicable people, but there's this constant threat over everyone that it's not very enjoyable.
I know.
See, your guys' screen time is so different than mine. Every night I end with The Middle and The Golden Girls.
That's funny. So you're living in the 80s syndication world. That's what
no
we did
kidding.
Before.
How are those your choices?
That's I'm just very funny. Happy, and I'm content with these shows. I don't need to watch those sad, sad shows.
Yeah. Well, we have enough drama in our lives. There's not a lot of drama in the Golden Girls episode.
You guys need a little
sure.
Sophia in your life, okay? She'll whip you into shape.
Griffin, do you have a show that you're looking at? Or do you don't have television, right? So you're not regularly watching anything right
you know,
now.
You know, they do have the shows online now. That's actually breaking news. Steve, maybe you want to cover that. You can watch TV on the internet.
Notice the difference between
internet.
Him and Elif. Elif right. doesn't throw a smack at me like that.
No.
Griffin does. Sorry,
I'm watching Younger. It's a TV Land show.
With Hilary Duff?
With Hilary Duff and Sutton Foster.
Wow.
That is really fun. And
that
again,
is really
that is a that is a show that's fun to look at. It's pretty.
Good.
The clothes are terrific. And there's a little drama, but ain't nobody getting killed on that show.
Not yet. I'm in season two.
Yeah, that's a fun show. That's a fun show.
Young and Hungry, Freeform. It's my guilty pleasure as well.
Yeah, I don't know that one. Young and Hungry,
yeah,
Freeform.
It's
Endeavor is the one I'm watching now.
Which one's that, Steve?
I liked Inspector Lewis and PBS Mystery, Masterpiece Mystery. Inspector Lewis was the old version. He would is the first. Anyway, it's a British cop mystery set in the 60s. It's Inspector Morse was big in the 70s, and this is the precursor to that. It's called Endeavor.
Well, it's no Golden Girls or Younger now, is it?
No.
Let's ask producer Matt Bubala and host Matt Bubala. I always introduce him as producer Matt Bubala because that's how Matt and I first worked together. He hosts a weekend show for us on WGN Radio, among other things. Hey, Matt, how are you?
I'm good, John. I thought I was having a bad day, but then I had to listen to your lives watching television. I feel better, so thank you for that.
Do you watch much TV, Matt? Is there a show that you go to when you want to get away from things?
You know what? I think you guys are right. It's funny that all the really high-quality shows today are so tough to enjoy because you're not rooting for anybody, right? We were watching also Sharp Objects. And what's the one on HBO that follows that? Is that Billions or Succession?
Yeah, right.
I just watched it last night with Brian Cox.
Oh,
my first
gosh.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seemed really good. And, I love Better Call Saul. which was the prequel to Breaking Bad.
I know, and I love that show. But again, I guess you root for Saul on that one. What's the matter,
hey,
Griff?
Matt? Matt, what do you call the last show of a season?
See, you know what's funny is I remember this, and I can't remember how I used to do that. It used to drive you insane. I believe the last show of the season would be the finale.
A season finale, not a series finale.
No, I know, but Matt used to always call it the finale. Yeah, it's the finale.
It's the finale, then. I'm sure I was right at the time. Hey, Violetta sounds like, she doesn't sound like she's making different choices. She's sounding like she's not paying for cable or Netflix or anything.
No, I do pay the cable bill in my household, which is my parents' household.
Yeah.
I didn't want cable. My dad wanted it.
Well, I just think the idea, these days, the TV can be an escape is, you know, an important and relevant idea, but what we end up going to is not serving that purpose that well.
Well, maybe the thing is you can't find the person to root for because it's hard to find that person in
real
life.
All I'm saying is if this were the Carter administration or something like that, then we'd need something to punch it up a little bit. But the world is punchy and hard enough as it is right now.
I guess TV.
But don't you think that takes us out of the reality of how tough the world can be by watching somebody rich and famous or whatever have, you know, tough times, and billions are incredibly rich, but they have all this drama or terrible things in their lives?
Here's what we need right now. We need friends to be invented right now. We need friends to just drop in our world and everybody fall in love with these six adorable characters.
Yeah.
I guess the shows...
You know, that we need to go back to friends.
The shows that galvanize conversation the most are the darker ones. Maybe.
Right.
But all that stuff is still out there, and maybe TV has changed since, like, the 70s. It would be easier to find something escapist on TV back then, but I don't think there's anything new about watching stuff with bad people in it. Like,
and plus, Jen, we still have Modern Family, Blackish, Superstore. There's still those general network comedies that are just kind of silly, goofy.
Sure, but where's your facts of life?
If you go back to, like, who are the bad people on the bad shows in the 70s, what do you have, the Ewings on Dallas or something?
It was the 80s.
I'm just stretching here, but all I'm saying is if this isn't a new thought, it's a new depth of depravity that we're watching.
Just as soon as you talk about the people in the shows that I watch, they're so messed up. I just think, well, Shakespeare... It's like not everybody was doing great in those either. You know, like, it's as old as entertainment itself is like watching people with problems.
Yeah, I guess so.
It was new on television with The Sopranos, but then it's really taken off from there. I mean, everything goes back to The Sopranos when you talk about that.
Hey, that's not why I called you, Producer Matt. I appreciate your thoughts on TV. This is a conversation we'll have on your show or my show another day. But you are in Indianapolis, and I called you because you had shared with us, and I mentioned it on our Saturday show, that the Little League team that you coach, the Tri-City All-Stars, won the state tournament, and they went to the regional tournament. In fact, we were able to watch your games on the ESPN app. And the region you guys are playing in, which is the Great Lakes region, only has six teams. You're playing the state champions of Michigan and Wisconsin and Ohio, places like that. And if you guys are successful there, then we will see you on Saturday on TV in the Little League World Series. So how did it go today?
Well, you won't be seeing us on TV. Unfortunately, we lost. It's a double elimination up until the championship. And we fell today to the All-Stars from the state of Ohio. 4-0.
I'm sorry about that, buddy.
Me too.
These are 12-year-olds, and
some are still 11. Some have already turned 13, but it's basically 12-year-olds. It's the major league. It's those kids that end up playing, you know, in the Little League World Series in Williamsport. If we had won today, our game Thursday night would have been broadcast nationally on ESPN.
Is there what kind of crowd? Did you guys play at that minor league ballpark they have in Indianapolis? Where did you play?
No, they play. There's a huge sports complex down here called Land Park, I believe. There's like 20 baseball fields and all sorts of stuff. It's right next to where the Colts have their training camp, and there's these beautiful fields. And so there's a, you know, you can't play in high school or minor league fields because the dimensions are too big.
Oh, yeah, right.
Little League is a 225-foot fence, and the pitching mound is 46 feet away. The bases are only 60 feet away. And so there's these beautiful complexes here, and they brought in stands, like high school football stands. So the whole thing was surrounded. They had a big scaffolding behind home plate where they had broadcasters from ESPN, and they had cameras on scissor lifts around the field. It's a pretty high-tech thing.
How many folks were at the games?
Probably, 50 or 60 from each side. I think the team that came the furthest is from Kearney, Nebraska. They probably have the fewest people, and Indiana stands have probably been more packed for their games. It's friends and family, whoever can make the trip down.
How nervous were you or the kids? I mean, this is the big time. This is the real deal.
Yeah, I think the very first game we played on Sunday morning, I think the boys were a bit nervous because you knew it was on ESPN and things like that. But I think once they start playing the game, it's kind of just the game. I think the nerves got to us a little bit. We had a rough first inning in our first game against Michigan, and they can really hit the ball. They put up four on us in the first inning, and we were never able to quite claw our way back into that one. We lost 7-2. And today against Ohio, we just couldn't get the bats rolling, and they played great defense and played some really good small ball and just kept scrapping away runs on us, and we just could not get our big bats going.
These are boys from East Dundee, West Dundee, Carpentersville, Algonquin, places like that, the northwest suburbs of Chicago. They're the
right.
State champs, and you're their coach. Do you sit back and go, oh, I should have sent Billy in the third inning, or we should have changed a pitcher out? I mean, is it possible the coach lost the game for the kids by any chance?
Wow, thanks, John.
I don't mean it that
way. We're just looking here. How did you blow this one, man? What did you do wrong? I don't know. I'm sure there's always things you could do differently, but there's nothing that stands out. We just, we won as a team and we lost as a team. Nobody had a really awesome day today. Nobody had a really terrible day today. It just didn't come together for us. And the kids from Ohio played a really good, smart game. And their coaches did really well. They played small ball in a couple innings where they laid down bunts that we could not get them thrown. It was crazy how well placed their bunts were. And when we bunted, they played defense so perfectly they got us. And, it just fell that way today. I'm very proud of the boys. They worked really hard. They did a great job. It's six champions, so they're all really good teams.
Yeah.
And the tournament director here, when she did the opening ceremony the other night, she said that this time of year, she said something like 3,400 Little League All-Star teams around the world, and there are 60 still playing right now. So if you made it from 3,400 to 60, it's not a bad season.
Yeah, no kidding. Just one last thing. When I watch the Little League World Series, Matt, and you guys are at that level, obviously, there's two things that stand out to me today versus any Little League team I ever played on or saw. The kids are bigger, stronger, faster. That the pitch is the equivalent of a 90-mile-an-hour major league pitch. And the kids are, some of them are busters, and they just crank on those things. They hit 250-foot home runs. Did you guys have those kind of powerful kids?
We do. We have two or three boys that hit 250. One boy probably hit a 300-foot home run this year. Kids are huge these days, more than when we were kids. And that's why this is actually the last year the Little League World Series will include any kids who are 13 years of age.
Oh.
They changed the ages a little bit, so it will only be a max of 12-year-olds after this year. They've switched. There was a brand-new bat this year that everybody had to get, specially designed bats from the manufacturers that are more like wood bats. In fact, there were kids on the team we played today using wood bats instead of metal bats because they hit about the same as wood bats. So they've really tried, I think, for the safety of the game because, there are kids here who are 6'2", 12-year-olds, throwing, like you said, 72, 73 miles an hour from 46 feet away. So, but the kids do get used to it. I mean, we have had our kids, for practices before we came down here, we had the older brothers from the team who are 16, 17 years old, pitching from 46 feet away and throwing at 75 miles an hour. And, with speed, kids just get used to the timing. And any baseball player, if it's coming in straight, it's about the timing and when you start. And, it has to be a quick reaction. But they do a pretty good job of catching up to that.
Yeah. Not to belabor that point, but, I was at the White Sox game last night, and the closer for the Sox, that Davidson guy, he's a position player. We were watching the speed gun after all of his pitches because they were just so much noticeably slower than the 96 we were seeing, and he was throwing pitches in the low 70s, Matt. You guys had guys from 46 feet throwing the same speed.
Yeah. From 46 feet, they're 6'2", so by the time they let go of the ball, they're about 40 feet away, and it's crazy. But the the harder they throw, the tougher time they have throwing strikes. And, you know, against Michigan, we were able to draw like 7 walks. They hit 2 or 3 of our batters. So we got a bunch of runners on base. Just had trouble coming up with the big hit when we needed it.
Congratulations to the Tri-Cities All-Stars, Matt Bubala. I saw a picture of you guys online. Who's the other adult coach, Matt? Who's the guy helping you there?
There were 2 others, Gil Duran and Sean Kustra, yeah. Both fathers of kids on the team.
Now, congratulations to you all. I know you're disappointed, but you must feel really good, and I hope they do, too.
Yeah, they do. Thank you very much, John. We appreciate it.
That's Matt Bubala. You'll hear him. Hey, Matt, are you still there?
I am still here.
Are you going to be on this weekend?
I am now, because I'm out in Wales, John.
Okay, well, we'll be listening this weekend, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, Matt's weekend's just cleared up. It's 2:50. Rokan Anadvantis getting radio in Studio A. We haven't talked much politics today. We did cover the Manafort trial with ABC, but otherwise we've been a little free of that. I suspect they'll catch you up on all things going on political. Remember, if politics these days upsets you, we have the cure. It's called Urillium Life 9000.
Yesterday, I didn't feel too well. My heart was racing. I was dizzy. Everyone was talking about what the president said.
Every day, more and more Americans are suffering from politosis, an illness caused by too much political talk. Symptoms of politosis include itchy eyes, runny nose, scaly skin, constipation, consternation, and erections that last over 4 hours.
I didn't have that.
Now's the time to give Urillium Life 9000 a try.
I took 2 Urillium Life 9000s in the morning, and by lunch I was calm, clean, and playing the piano. Which is weird because I don't know how to play the piano.
Ask your doctor if Urillium Life 9000 is right for you. Don't take Urillium if you have high blood pressure, low systolic pressure, or know anyone named Melvin.
Look at me. I'm walking in a park.